KYW Original Podcasts.
Did they say anything to you before they shot you?
When I unlocked the door, I felt a presence. Like, I remember all my hairs on my arms standing up. I was like, something isn't right. So when I turned around, I seen these two guys. And I locked my door, quickly locked my door, and I stepped off my step. And I said, what's up? And he said, one of the guys said, well, you already know what this is. And I'm like, well, I ain't got nothing. You know, I knew what he was talking about. He wanted to rob me. As I turned around, and at that moment when I went to yell, run, and I was going to run, I was shot. And when I was shot, everybody ran.
This is the KYW Weekly Dive, where we take a closer look at a story we're telling here on KYW News Radio. I'm Carol McKenzie. Philadelphia's battle with gun violence is testing the city's elected leaders and leaving an extraordinary trail of suffering. Today, a conversation with one of the victims left in the wake.
You have to see this carnage every day.
Someone opened fire.
Everybody ready? All right.
There were about 60 people at this party.
You said this was a graduation party.
At least one individual came up and fired.
The police say six people were shot, four of them between 15 and 17 years old.
It makes you shake your head that people have to pull out guns to resolve their conflicts, but it seems like that's where we are in this country, and it's a sad commentary.
Did you know anybody who was at that party?
They're from Philadelphia. They're part of the family. You don't have to know somebody to emphasize what the situation. I do know plenty that have been murdered.
That was the news on Monday morning a week ago. A gunman shot up a graduation and Father's Day party. Several people were hit, including four teenagers. One man died. He was 24 years old. He is now one of the more than 150 people killed in Philadelphia this year already. KYW's Tim Jimenez went to the playground in Southwest Philadelphia just hours after the graduation party shooting, and he joins us now. Tim, thanks for being here. What was your first impression when you got on scene in the morning?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it's very early in the morning, let's say 4 a.m. or so, very dark, so you couldn't really see much. But we saw a cop car stationed there by the park. And then when the sun was coming up, you could really start to see that there was this party going on the night before. There was a white canopy still set up by a baseball diamond, several grills underneath, a couple of cases of water, plates with food still on them, a single red balloon, which was connected to the table, and a sign flat on the ground that said, the party's here. So really chilling.
It was very surreal. I saw your picture on Instagram, and that was one of the things I noticed as well. Lawn chairs, tables, just looked like people had gotten up and left the party.
Exactly. And then when you know what happened,
yeah,
it's really shocking to think about that. For example, the food on the plates still there. People probably just dropped them to run away from gunfire. They heard something. They saw people down on the ground. It was truly a frightening thing. It was supposed to be a celebration.
What did happen?
From what we understand from police is that three people were in the parking lot nearby this party as this party was going on about 10 o'clock that Sunday night, the night before. And one of those people ended up firing shots into this crowd. Indiscriminately is the word that police used. So without rhyme or reason, according to police. And again, as you mentioned, several people went down and one person unfortunately was killed.
And you managed to catch up with a woman who was there when this happened.
Yes.
Say, oh my God, somebody got a shot.
This woman talked about, she was very emotional as she got there.
They say somebody come and just shoot.
Talked about what happened the night before. She really shed some light on what this all was. Now, she said it was a joint graduation and Father's Day party that was put together by several families, part of the African immigrant community that lives there in that part of Southwest Philadelphia. And, you know, we weren't sure exactly who this party was for before we talked to this woman, but she said it was for several people, several of the young people who graduated from high school, also with some of the fathers in the community. And she said she left the party because she had been cooking all day. You know, things were going great. She was enjoying herself, but, you know, she was cooking all day. It was hot. She went home to get a shower. She's at home. She tells us she got a call from her son. He's frantic.
Screaming.
Saying, Mom, there was a shooting.
They say, oh, Mommy shot. Where are you? I say, I'm home. What happened?
And, you know, she was obviously freaked out by all that. And the way it was described to her from her son, you know, a bunch of the young people, they were in a circle. They were dancing to some African music. All of a sudden, again, that one person, whoever it was, started to open fire. And then all of a sudden, people start going down. And the one person who went down, who eventually was the 24-year-old who was killed, She describes, or the son describes it to her, as he's not moving. He just wasn't moving. He was on the ground.
It's horrific. I mean, you know, how many parties have you been to? Graduation parties, Father's Day, yep, birthdays, and you're outside and having fun. You're just not thinking somebody could walk up and shoot up this party and it could end like that.
Exactly. And one person we talked to, he thought he heard fireworks. Ends up, and it turns out they were gunshots. That scared his dog, you know, those sounds, the pop, pop, pop. We asked him, you know, is this something that... is that something you think about in terms of violence happening at this park? He said, no, you got basketball court here. You got these baseball diamonds. Kids play lacrosse. Usually, he says, it's the last thing he thinks about happening there is anything violent. So for this to happen, you know, it shocked people in the neighborhood.
Then you think about the poor kids who are celebrating their graduation, to have this now permanently, this tragedy permanently attached to what should be a really joyous time in their lives.
Yep, you have wounded friends, you have a friend who was killed. To that be associated with, as you mentioned, something so positive, a great accomplishment, mm-hmm, in your life, your family's there. Again, this is a community of immigrants, African immigrants, who, you know, just came to this country for really a better life. That's what that woman told me, is that we came here, and this is the greatest country in the world, she says. But for this to happen, really, wow, I mean, she was taken aback.
On Monday night, the people who live in the neighborhood where the shooting happened came together for a peace walk.
I'm protesting for violence because I'm trying to make it stop. So we're doing a walk to make violence stop. And I know parents are tired of losing their children on the streets every day. And I lost my brother to gun violence. He's 15 years old, named Mualia, and he died August 22nd, 2018. So, yeah.
Kristen Johansson covers crime in the city for KYW News Radio. 30 people were shot in one weekend alone. Since the beginning of June, Kristen, you said it's been about a dozen people shot every weekend. And the people of Philadelphia, this has been going on for decades. This is not anything new. There's a culture of violence in this city that people are living with. And the leaders have yet to figure out how to stem the violence. And I want to listen to what the mayor had to say about that shooting at that graduation Father's Day party.
Well, we're investing in a number of areas, including education, obviously, from, you know, pre-K through the investments we're making in elementary school and high school, our investments in CTE schools, our investments in summer jobs, our investments in anti-violence programs. The bottom line is that you can get a gun in the city faster than you can get a library card. And apparently the federal government and the state government believes that people should have unfettered access to guns.
So, Kristen, you have the bit about the library card is shocking.
Yeah, basically, we tried to see here in the newsroom if we could buy an AR-15 or something like that. There was a robbery in West Philly, and we were like, how do they get an AR-15? So we did a quick Google search, and we were able to get to the point where all we would have had to put in is our billing address. Like, that was it. And it took us minutes. There was no background check. There was no question about who I was or anything like that. That is how easy it is to get a high-powered weapon. So far this year, we've had approaching about 700 people shot in the city. We're at about 650 right now.
Wow.
That's up 7% from last year, which had been 600 people. And then also our homicide rate, we are about 156. That changes about every day, but it's been steady about 10% above last year.
So one thing that Ross Krasner and the mayor agree on is that there needs to be a multi-pronged approach. But the part where they differ is when it comes to law enforcement.
All right. In just a few moments, we're going to hear from Police Commissioner Richard Ross.
The commissioner said something very interesting during a press conference after that party shooting. And let's listen to that.
Let's not forget about the victims. Let's not become so offender-centric in our focus that we forget about the people that are out there in these neighborhoods who are being victimized either directly or indirectly. Directly meaning you're one of the individuals that was robbed, burglarized. Indirectly is you have to see this carnage. You have to deal with it every day.
I live outside the city. And every time I hear about something like this, I think, I don't think twice when my kids go out the door to play at the park or ride the bicycle. I'm not afraid they're getting shot. I can't imagine what it's like to live with that reality where you're afraid to allow your child to play on your front porch.
And that's the indirect victim that he's speaking to. He's saying there's people that are just hearing gunfire on their street all the time. Our producer here, Tom, and I went out for an interview in West Philadelphia, and we were approaching a woman's house, and we rang the doorbell, and it took her about 5 minutes to first unlock her inside door, about three or four different locks, come outside, then unlock it another three or four times that she had, like, to the patio, and then basically locking everything as we came in. All of the blinds are down. All of the windows are shut. She's lived on that block forever. Her kids used to play out on that block until the shooting started, and she is terrified. Absolutely terrified. So that's the indirect victim.
It affects everybody, like you said. But we want to bring in someone now.
Who's a direct victim.
A direct victim. Lou Berrios. Lou, thank you so much for coming in today. So let's talk about your story. What happened to you?
Coming to my home, walking to my house. Around 1 a.m, two guys tried to rob me. And during an attempted robbery, I was shot in my back.
Oh.
And left there at my front doorstep.
Did they say anything to you before they shot you?
When I unlocked the door, I felt a presence. Like, I remember all my hairs on my arms standing up. I was like, something isn't right. So when I turned around, I seen these two guys. And I locked my door, quickly locked my door, and I stepped off my step. And I said, what's up? And he said, one of the guys said, well, you already know what this is. And I'm like, well, I ain't got nothing, you know. I knew what he was talking about. He wanted to rob me. As I turned around to tell my friend Julian to run, and at that moment when I went to yell, run, and I was going to run, I was shot.
What happened? Who found you?
When I was shot, first thing I did was pull out my phone and call 911. I fell to my knees, and when my head touched the ground, I passed out. I do remember officers pulling me into their vehicle and then passing out again and waking back up when I was in the emergency room. So on the gurney, going in, passing out. And the next time I woke up, I seen some family members. You know, after surgery, I think I did about 12 hours, they said, in surgery. I was constantly having infections and just trying to get my mental state back to where it should be. A lot of fear. For weeks, months, every day, I got shot in my dream. I would go to sleep and wake up. And not only would I dream that I got shot, I felt it. Like, I would wake up and I would feel the pain. It was a recurrent dream of me walking into my house and fighting two men, and like, but fighting for my life and then being shot. You know, now it's like 4th of July is approaching and got fireworks. Even that alone is triggering, you know. I'm never going to be the same. You know, I hear about people getting shot and they get up and they're back on the street. And I ask the question, like, how? When I'm constantly scared, you know, I don't feel safe. I haven't been home in about 6 weeks, so...
So I know you just said you had a really long physical recovery. Let's start with that. How long were you in the hospital and what did that involve besides the surgeries?
So when I was shot, the bullet went through, I was shot in my back. It went through my lung. It hit my bladder, my liver. It hit my intestines twice. It took half of my pancreas, the right side of my colon. I had a tube in my lung. To drain my the fluid in my lung, the blood. I had a tube in my my kidneys, my liver. I had a feeding tube in my stomach, and then a bunch of draining tubes. So when I was shot, the bullet never came out. It sat in me for 5 months first. So I had a lot of internal bleeding. It was trying to like have all these organs heal. It was. Fevers of 102, almost 103 every night. Doctors couldn't explain, you know, why or figure out why I was getting so sick. I was in a lot of pain with a lot of pain meds, but still feeling the pain. And my second day, I I told him, I need to get up. I needed to know I was able to walk. Mm. I mean, I moved my toes. You see on TV, you know, you move your toes, you're good. No, I needed to know. So the second day, I, you know, tried to tell the doctors, like, I'm getting up, call somebody. And I walked for maybe about 30, 45 seconds before my heart rate reached 160. They couldn't lower my heart rate. And that was like their biggest concern. Also, when they took the tube out of my mouth, my right side of my vocal cord was damaged. It collapsed. So I wasn't able to talk for weeks. So it was a struggle. And I think after about a month or two, I really sat down, I really prayed and tried to figure out how to beat this. Like, I'm still alive, you know. How do I move forward? It was, you know, a lot of prayer and finding forgiveness for the people who shot me.
And that part's its own remarkable story, right, Lou?
Yeah.
Tell us what you did.
Well, I was in the hospital my first couple months. I started drafting a letter. I wanted to, I was angry. I was, I'm not going to lie. I couldn't wrap my head around of, why would you want to kill me? What have I done wrong? You know, I've always been in the field of helping people and working with homeless youth. And my job before I got shot was trying to enroll people into a tech school, you know, help them get off the streets in my neighborhood, help them get off the streets. Let's get you a career. So getting shot, I couldn't wrap my head around it, you know. So I became really angry. And I just started drafting a letter of trying to tell the people who shot me how angry I was, but how hurt I was. And then as I started, you know, getting in touch with like my faith and praying, I let that anger go. And the letter was drafted to let them know that I forgive them. I forgive them because I couldn't continue to be hurt. I couldn't. I needed to figure a way to heal. And if I can let go of the hate, then I can really pay attention to me, mind, body, and soul, and heal. So I drafted a letter to say, you know, even if I hurt you, there's a pardon letter that says, even if I hurt you, I apologize. If I did anything wrong to you, I apologize. But to kill me, I don't understand that part, you know. So once that letter was drafted, a few months later, me and some friends, we went around the neighborhood and we passed out about 400 letters in the neighborhood and the community, hoping that the people who shot me received that letter.
Did you ever find out who shot you?
No. No.
Do you think they saw the letter?
Yeah. I believe they did. There was, you know, when I put out the letter, I was kind of at first confused of like the reaction I got from people. So it was more of like the older community that's been around for so long. They're like, I don't want nothing to do with this. Like you said, I'm afraid to sit on my porch, you know, because I don't know when I'm going to be the one shot. You know, it was the young community was like, man, what's going on? And, you know, there was times that I even had to like break down a letter to them, and which saddened me. Like, you don't even understand what's going on. You can't read this and actually understand it. And they were like, wow. You know, one thing I didn't mention is before I passed out, my last words was, God, please, please don't kill me. I don't want to die. Like, save me. And when I woke up the next day and I found out what happened, everything hit me, my prayer was answered. I couldn't go back out there. Can I pick up a gun? Can I find a gun? Yeah. I mean, it's so easy now to be like, I need this and somebody will get it for you. But I'm alive. I'm blessed. Being alive and getting a second opportunity in life, you have to be smart. You have to change. I want to help the same community that I was shot in, you know, because I feel so bad. And there's so many things that people are hurt. You know, we're losing funding in schools where there's no kind of community. There's no help. You know, therapy's not there. There's no access to. There's so many things that could be done. And I hear everybody talking about these gun laws and but there's so many little things that can be done.
And that's the one when you're talking about recovering. I mean, it's remarkable what you did with the letter after all that pain. But But my thought was, were you ever offered therapy? Were you ever offered mental health, you know, access to mental health, you know, professionals? Is that something that happens to people who have been through this, been shot?
So this is the first time I've asked this question. And my first month, I not only asked, I cried because I needed help. I could not, the thoughts, the flashbacks, it was so much. And I can honestly say, you know, Temple did a really great job on surgery, did a really good job on saving my life. But when it came down to mental health, I had to fight for it. I had to fight. I had to have my doctors, my primary doctors, find somebody for me to talk to. And it was only when I left Temple that I found counseling and therapy.
And how instrumental has that been? Do you think not only for your recovery, but with your attitude and your willingness to forgive and to keep walking down that path? Because I think at any moment it'd be easy, like you said, to pick up a gun when you're fighting the pain and the anger.
It's helped. It's helped a lot. And I encourage, even if you didn't go through what I've went through, it's always good to talk, because that building up, I believe the two people who shot me, you know, if they had somebody to talk, maybe they wouldn't have shot me, you know, but I think it's helped dramatically. I was losing it. You know, it was a part that I felt being in a hospital. I was in a hospital almost 50 days, my first go round, and I felt them walls closing in on me. And I would tell Temple, I need help. I need you to bring somebody. I need to talk to somebody. It was a lot, and it's only showing me how strong I am and that I have a purpose. And, you know, when I get myself right and together, I'm going to help and fight to change what's going on out here in these streets.
Your recovery is remarkable on so many levels, And the fact that you were able to suffer through something so just physically horrific and then emotionally, psychologically horrific. But to be able to sit here and share your story with us today and tell us how you so quickly came around to forgiving the people who shot you.
You know, a lot of people, you know, personally, like, how? I could never forgive. It's something you practice. You have to learn. I had to learn it really, really quick and practice it every day. Every day, because there was times in my recovery that I questioned my existence. I was in so much pain. And there was no pain meds they could have gave me that would make that pain go away. I had to really every day pray and say, like, I forgive these people. I forgive these people. It's hard, especially living in the house that you got shot in front of. It's so hard, you know, going in there and or being by my window. I sat by my window for months. I looked out. And what I didn't want is to point every person that looked like the people who shot me to be like, they shot me. They shot me. They shot me. You know, and I didn't want to live like that.
When you talk about forgiveness, I think what many people see it as that something you're giving to the people who shot you, mm-hmm. and that you're letting them off the hook. Mm-hmm. But it's a gift you give yourself.
Yeah. You actually free yourself. And when I passed out the letter, I felt so much just be released from me. I was smiling. I was happy to be out there. I was walking with a cane, and we passed out 400 letters, and I was happy to talk to, you know, the community. Everybody says, man, I can't believe you still live there. Like, it's hard, you know, especially, you know, with the surgery I had and, you know, still recovering, you know, still having pain. You know, it was hard to move, but I'm there, you know.
How do you get past what you just said? Not looking at every person who walks down the street without thinking, is that the person who shot me? How do you deal with that?
It's hard. I guess when I say I forgive, it's the part you let it all go.
It's a lot to let go, Lou.
You have to let it go. You can't say you forgive and you hold on. You don't forget. Like, I would never forget. And there's times that, you know, I'm with my friend, and if we're in the car and it's late, it's like, roll up the windows, lock the door, or did you hear that sound? You know, I still have that. But when I say I forgave these two people, it was to let it all go.
Do you still hope that there's some arrest? Would that help, or some conviction? Does that help you at all if they were to find the people that did this to you? And
yes and no. Yes, because they have to be held accountable for what they've done. And a part of me is like, honestly, if I see them tomorrow, they ask for help, I help them. I need to know why, though. I need to know, like, what is it you needed so bad that you shot me? How were you so angry? Why? Like, I'm more sad that you're that angry to be able to shoot somebody, you know? And, but when it comes down to, yeah, they have to be held accountable for what they've done.
Today, I know you're still dealing with pain and you're still even recovering from your injuries. Have you been able to go back to work at all? Are you planning to? And are you planning to do the same thing?
I'm dying to go back to work. I'm not even going to lie. But I'm out for about a year and a half.
Wow.
For recovery. Right now, it's the day-to-day thing and just trying to survive. And
just worrying about meeting your basic needs while trying to heal from this.
Yeah.
That's a lot of stress.
It is. I got therapy.
Let's say that they find the guys who did this. You know, I mean, they're charged, let's say, with, you know, shooting, maybe attempted murder. What would you want to see happen in that process?
So I would expect the justice system to do what they're supposed to do. I'm not going to sentence anybody. I hope they get what they're supposed to. You know, you left me for dead. No, I forgive you, yes, but I'm not, you know, I don't want to go to court and hear that they got 1 to 5 and they're out in a year and a half because they've learned nothing.
You want some rehabilitation for them probably? And
yeah,
and
yeah, if you can pick up a gun and shoot somebody you've never met, there's something seriously wrong and you need help. A lot of people don't have access to mental health. Yeah, they're going to need a lot of help.
Everybody who talks about this talks about the culture of violence and the fact that, you know, people get swept up in this because it's what you grow up in. Mm-hmm. How do you, I mean, I think the mental health aspect of it is crucial, but it's interesting because that's not what anybody talks about. Everybody says, the mayor said, I don't have the answer to get people out of the mindset, somebody's going to come with a gun and shoot at 70 people at a party. What do I do with that? But it sounds like from your perspective, a big part of that, what do I do about that, is somehow get mental health counseling into these communities.
Yeah. But a lot of these communities are broken. They're just left there. It's poor people trying to survive. When you talk about mental health in the Black and Brown community, okay, it's so much stigma. You know, like, I don't want to be on meds. I don't want somebody to think I'm crazy, you know. So mental health is a big key, especially when you wake up every morning and you walk out your door and you see nothing but violence, trash. Growing up, when I walked out my door, as a little kid, I even felt it. Like, we live in broken communities, you know. Even in schools, I think that they need to have people come in and start speaking about this gun violence, you know, and because these kids are our future. They're the ones out there, and if you walk in these communities, they're the ones selling drugs now. They're the ones fighting. They're the ones doing the robberies because it's so easy to say, hey, you're 15 years old, you're going to get off, you know, versus me at 25, 35, 40 years old. Now I'm going to be there for life. There's no guidance. There's no summer camp. There's no, it's nothing, you know. You said something in the beginning, letting your child go in these neighborhoods, you know, and how you live in a neighborhood and you don't worry about that because you don't have to, you know. But in these neighborhoods, yeah, I it's like I worry about me stepping out my door. You know, I worry about my nephews stepping out. And it's hard because it's to hear that in a weekend, 20, 30 people got shot in my city, I'm just like, That is bananas. Anybody, I always tell, if you're not doing anything, then you're part of this problem, because anybody, it can happen to anyone. I wasn't out there selling drugs. I wasn't sitting on the stoop. I worked, you know. I stepped out to my first Eagles game. I still watch them videos of me being in the Eagles game, having fun. And I came home and still got shot. You know, people talk about how do we fix this problem.
Yeah.
Beyond that, there's so many black and brown nonprofits people are building. People are trying to, like, create with no money to help these communities. And it's, if we can start focusing on these people, you know, are trying to get into the community that look like the same people who are, you know, doing the shooting, I think there will be a change. But it's putting money back into these communities. You know, it can't be a struggle of, like, what I'm going to eat today. Because if I can't eat today, I'm definitely going to take it from somebody else. And that's the mentality that's out there. I have nothing to feed my kids, or, you know, it's like a lot of people say, well, they need to get up and get a job. It's that easy to up and get a job. But when you can't get a job because you do have a pass, you know, I haven't been like this all my life. I have a past as well. It's hard for me to get work. I just chose to change my life. And it takes time.
Why do you think that it is that we say kids, but young men pick up guns in the first place?
I think that it's become a norm. Like, it's a crazy norm now. It's like, oh, you're mad, pick up a gun. If they don't get caught, they get what they call clout. You know, they get this. Oh, he did this, you know. But I think there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of hurt. And like I've been saying, these communities, they're tired of asking. People are tired of asking. They're taking now. And if you and they have the mentality, you hurt me, I hurt you back. They don't have anybody to talk to. They have nobody they can trust. They weren't taught that part. Let's talk about it. Or why does it have to go that far for you to pick up a gun?
Oh, this affects, I mean, yeah. I just had a friend text me about two shootings that happened near her house, and she's terrified. You know, I mean, this happened, it's, and they have jobs and they have a mm-hmm. kid, and, you know, I mean, this is just something that's throughout the city. And, mm-hmm. you know, Commissioner Ross does speak to those kids. You need to not pick up the gun in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You need something, go to a teacher, go to a mentor, go to a police officer, do something else, but don't pick up the gun. You have the police, which is police commissioner, you know, speaking. You have the district attorney's office. You have community groups. You have the mayor. You have legislatures in Pennsylvania and in the city and the city councilman. It's back to what we were talking about, Carol. Mm-hmm. It's all of these people with different ideas of how to do something and right. solve the problem.
There was that one bite, Kristen, that one sound bite from the commissioner that was really unusual.
So really, for the first time, he said, it's not just us. Shootings go up, homicides go up. You guys always come to us and you want to hear about the statistics and you want to hear about what happened. This is about the entire criminal justice system. Somebody then point blank asked him at this press conference, are you talking about Krasner? Do you think he's too lenient? Do you think he's too light on crime? And he said, it's not just one entity. It's not just Krasner. It's the whole system. It's the judges. And he goes through who it is. Like, and he's not trying to point blame away from himself. He says this. He's just saying that he's not the only, it's not just the police department every time. The laws, Gabby Gifford, her gun safety or her gun prevention website gives us a C rating in Pennsylvania. We don't have strict gun laws. And even here in Pennsylvania, we do have some gun laws here, like the violations Uniform Fire Act and any, you know, arrests or convictions that happen under that. And the district attorney is deciding to have this diversion program, which basically gets people out on a probation. It's kind of set up for something like stealing a pack of gum or a sweater or something like that. It's ARD.
Right. And then so the ARDs are usually mainly for, as you said, minor crimes. And you have a story about that shocking doesn't even cover it.
There is somebody who, I mean, well, we got a list from a source within the district attorney's office for all of the ARDs that were given to people within 2018, this past year. And we went through that list. And Some of those people had been charged with attempted murder in the past, have been charged with theft, have been charged with robbery, have been charged with drug charges, have been charged with assault, aggravated assault. There's a list that goes beyond this, and they were given an ARD. ARD was set up, as it's been explained to me by lawyers, police. ARD was set up to kind of divert people. It's the accelerated rehabilitation program, but it's supposed to diversion program. It's supposed to divert people from doing something bad. So you do something, you know, you steal a sweater. They're like, you're not supposed to steal that sweater. This is your first time offense. You know, we'll put you, just don't do anything bad in the next 2 years and we'll kind of wipe it from your record. But if you do something about next 2 years, this may come up and bite you in the butt. There's a particular person who was recently arrested for a May homicide that basically was given ARD, but had previously also been given ARD for something else. And it was within that past year. And they go out and allegedly, you know, shoot and kill somebody. It's happening a bunch. I asked Krasner about this.
I mean, do you guys think about ARD? I've heard some cases have ARD has been brought in some of the VUFA cases. Is that something you, and why do you choose?
Well, there's always been ARD in some VUFA cases. There always should be ARD in some VUFA cases, although a very small portion. You know, I would ordinarily, I think you're probably looking at a couple percent or less. But it is appropriate when you have someone who is a truly law-abiding person, who can be held accountable and put on probation without getting a conviction, and that person meets certain kinds of criteria. Number one, no indication of involvement in criminal activity. Number two, many, many of them are going to be people who purchased the gun lawfully. Number three, no kind of criminal record that's troubling, anything of that sort. And sometimes you'll even see situations, for example, a car is stopped and the driver says, oh, by the way, officer, I'm carrying a firearm. You know, I have the clip in my left pocket. I have the gun in my right pocket. I just wanted you to know that, okay? Some of these folks, it's a small number, but a couple percent, something like that, are just really nice people who do not have a criminal past or future and who are liable to be pushed toward crime if they are convicted of a felony and it affects their ability to get a job, to get an education, to get a home loan. We don't want to push anyone towards crime. So it has always been the case that in Philadelphia there was some ARD and some gun cases, and that is appropriate.
He says the ultimate goal in the first place is for young men not to pick up a gun, you know, in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But the flip side of that is we get into, defense attorneys I've spoken to have said that their defendants, their clients ask for a Krasner offer or a Krasner special. And some detectives have said that they have them on tape asking for the Krasner offer, the Krasner special. So there's also this mindset that he's going to be light on sentences. So why not just, you know, just do it anyway? I mean, this is according to the defense attorneys that I've spoken to. And I'm not saying it's everyone by any means, but it's definitely the mindset that, you know, here you are in this very light offense kind of, you know, we're not really going to prosecute the crimes the way that we're supposed to prosecute the crimes. And really in the court system, the way that it's set up is the prosecutor is supposed to fight for the victims and the defense is supposed to fight for the defendants. And in every, you know, my mother always said there's three sides to every story, right? So you have the victim's story, you have the defendant's story, and then you have what really happened or whatever the judge decides. And that's kind of what the judge, and, you know, Ross does also point to the judges giving some of these. But here's the funny thing. We as Philadelphians all elect these people. So really kind of, like you're saying, comes back to us and the community. We elect them.
But one of the things that when you were talking about Krasner, talking about ARD, the reason he uses that is if you're convicted of a felony, it makes it hard to get a job, get a loan. How do you straddle that? You need to be held accountable. But Krasner's, you know, idea that if you are held accountable and convicted of a felony, you know, is that a good enough excuse to let people off with an ARD? Or
if I could share a story, I have a friend who went through the program and she said, you know, I asked her about it. I was like, well, what? She was like, all I had to do is get a $250 money order, and it was a drug charge. And we sat there, and you pay for the class, and they just let her go. So she said, I sat there for about an hour, and we were done. So when I think about these programs they have for people, so they don't get the felons and or the felonies and they're able to get a job, it's you're not doing anything for them. If there's some type of help, if there's some type of counseling, if there's some type of like, look, this is what you did wrong, this is what you need to do, then yes. But if you're just slapping them on the wrist and letting them go and they're coming back with something, if they stole a pack of gum, like you said, and then the next time they come back, they shot somebody, it's your fault, you know? And that's how I feel, you know? And for these guys who shot me, no, you go to court. It's hard. It's so hard. I don't want nobody to get life, you know? But I also don't want anybody to kill anybody. It's like, how do you help this person? Jail? If you have to go to prison, there has to be somehow. Some type of like you're helping people. You can't just let somebody sit there 20 years and when they come out, expect them to be okay. Because they're the same ones that are going to pick up a gun again. Why? Because they have so much anger. They sat in a box for 20 years.
Or they have no opportunities. I can't imagine. Yeah. You hear about these people being released and you think, they're just, here you go.
Yeah.
Well, they have no support. They have no one to help them get back on their feet. And if you've been in prison for 20 years, the world's changed.
Well, many of them go to halfway houses in between, you know, just to get out. They're in halfway houses and they meet other people. And sometimes that can spur something else. So like you're saying, there's no program really where they can go into job training programs. Sometimes there are. There are some job training programs for specific offenses. But as a whole, it's not usually like that. But I wonder what it's like for a victim. It's incredibly interesting to me to hear you say that these programs, there's nothing that they really learn from it or gain from it. It's kind of just like you said, now they're $250, you know, out of their pocket. But what do they get out of it?
That is a problem because then we talk about these laws and they're going right back out there, and they're the same offenders, you know. They're doing the same thing over and over. If you're not doing your job, you know, if we're not doing the job right, then no. Yeah, these people are going to keep getting off. Like, yeah, if you're going to give them the Krasner, whatever it is, you know.
The Krasner special.
This Krasner special, and you're not supporting them or helping them, then you're not doing anything. You're part of a really, really large problem.
Lou, thank you so much for being with us. Your insight and your story is incredible. And we wish you the best on your continued recovery. And can't thank you enough. And it sounds like, you know, this problem is multi-pronged. And it sounds like, frankly, everybody has maybe some good ideas, but it sounds like from what you're saying, we're just still not doing enough and we're not doing maybe what we need to be doing. And I mean, as a community as a whole, to end this cycle of gun violence in this city.
I thank y'all for having me.
Here are some of the other things that are happening in the news right now. Investigators are chasing new leads in a 45-year-old cold case. Margaret Fox disappeared in Burlington City, New Jersey when she was 14 years old. The police have released audio of a ransom demand.
$10,000 might be a lot of bread, but your daughter's life is the butter topping.
Who is it?
If you recognize that voice, let police know. The FBI is offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. Five of the six people charged with helping smuggle 35,000 pounds of cocaine into a Philadelphia port on board a container ship have had court appearances. Federal prosecutors have been able to seal the court documents, so whoever was behind the drug ship is still a mystery. That's all for the KYW Weekly Dive. Thank you to KYW's Kristen Johansson for being on the podcast this week and for bringing in Lou Berrios. A big thank you to Lou for coming in and having the courage to share your story with us. I'm Carol McKenzie. I'll talk to you next time.